This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Today, we'd like to welcome Dr. Seth Aberton, an associate professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Aberton. How do you do?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Could you start by telling us a bit about the research you do at UBC?
So my primary area of focus is adolescent suicide, in particular, the diffusion of suicide in specific places like high schools and smaller communities. And so I'm interested in why this happens, why it clusters in some places and not others, and sort of the, not as much in the prevention side of it, but the postvention side, that is, you know, how a school or community responds after an adolescent suicide, especially a high profile one, and what works and doesn't work to prevent further suicidality, whether it's more suicide ideation or a spate of attempts, or in the worst, obviously, case scenarios where there's ensuing suicides, completed suicides.
Yeah, I can understand how a lot of this could be relevant to COVID. It's like society is shifting so fast and the new normal is changing constantly. And I can understand how sociologists could be interested in that sort of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. On the one hand, it's still a little early to tell what exactly in terms of suicidality is happening. The numbers I've seen across, like internationally across nations, shows that suicide is actually down among adolescents in a lot of cases. And this could simply be a problem of reporting, that is, like, schools are not being able to react in the same way. They're not able to surveil kids in the same way. From the research I'm doing right now in a couple of communities, part of the reason I think it's down is that the usual pressures and stresses and bullying aspects of school is obviously down. So kids who are socially awkward or who struggle with the pressures of school, or, you know, who are in a school where there's a certain norm of what a kid is like or looks like or whatnot, and they don't fit that norm, they're not in that world right now. And so there's sort of some protective elements to it. More generally though, to your question, like, there's a lot of more mental health issues, I think, that are popping up. And I think it all is related to more about connectivity. That is, the realities of these kids' lives have been completely shifted to the online world. And I think we're getting an answer to a big question, whether online interaction is as satisfying to people as in-person interaction. And I think when this is all said and done, the answer will be no. But that's a bigger question that requires more data that I don't have access to. But in my own observations, I think kids are suffering a lot from just their not having the norm, not what their parents went through or what you and I went through of going to school every day. Even the kids who hated school, I think, are struggling with the fact that they're not living a normal adolescent life right now.
I find it interesting that some of the reported suicide numbers are down. I would assume that it was pretty much universally thought that everyone hated living at home and not going to school. But it sounds like there are just a few kids out there that are probably more comfortable in this sort of environment.
I think that's probably true. I mean, and I, like I said, I think that there's still a lot of time that and more data collection that's required. I mean, these are It's like, I guess the analogy would be like a presidential or a prime minister or like a provincial election where, you know, you kind of get a snapshot of why voting happened in a certain way, but it usually takes time to unpack everything that happened. And I think we just don't know, you know, what the short and long-term effects are. But I just think that the pressure is much more reduced, you know, and in my observations of like the high achieving kids, for instance, it's harder obviously online, but you know, talking to teachers and observing like various sort of weekly mental health meetings, I think what's happened is even the honors classes, they've reduced the assignments and like the expectations. They brought it down to the bare bones of what is really necessary for what kids need to know. And I think that that's helpful because the pressure is still there. They still want to get A's. They still want to do really well, but the actual number of things they have to do are low. And so for a high achieving kid, the connectivity thing is still hard, but the actually jumping through the hoops, the formal stuff is actually much lower. And the teachers are obviously much more sympathetic too. And so the grading, I have no evidence of this, but I would guess the grading is also probably a little less intense. I know as a professor, I am much quicker to give the benefit of the doubt to my students, knowing that, you know, the world that they're inhabiting right now is completely crazy. You know, I don't know what a person's home life is like. And so they say, I'm struggling. I have to assume that they probably are struggling, you know? And so I think that there's like a bigger cushion right now for kids, for adolescents that just isn't there when they're in school and dealing with the social pressure on top of the academic pressure, on top of the athletic, you know, pressure, at least in the United States.
Yeah, definitely. Those are some good points to share there, Dr. Howerton. We'll be right back here on Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM after just one message.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
We're back here on Research Review CITR 101.9 FM, and today we are interviewing Dr. Seth Aberton, a sociology professor at UBC. So, one thing that we're noticing a lot is, as you said, a shift in our interactions, our social, work, educational interactions from that sort of like physical in-person format to more of a online, on the internet, digital format. And I know you've done some research on, should I say like digital sociology in the past, is that correct?
I mean, I've not done a lot, but I definitely am, you know, plugged into that sort of subfield a little bit, yeah. And I have some speculations on top of that about just in terms of thinking about human interaction and what we would expect. So, I mean, the digital world is a strange world. I'll give you one good example. This speaks back to the question of suicide and mental health. I was in a district mental health meeting. So there are these meetings where, like the law enforcement side of the schools and the socio-emotional and behavioral side of the schools, they get together weekly and discuss various cases that they're dealing with. And they were commenting on how much fewer problems they've been experienced. And again, this could be a monitoring thing where kids aren't in school, right? The principal, the vice principal, the various people are not sending them to somewhere and like writing them up for behavioral issues. But one of the comments, it was anecdotal, but one of the comments one of the folks in there said about their own kid who's a high school age was that by, you know, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, they were so screened out that they were so tired of screens that they didn't want to even be on social media anymore. And so I mean, there's a, you know what I mean? There's like a mental health piece here that I think that kids don't even want to connect with each other online because they spend all day in a class online. And I don't know where they're getting their social interaction at that point, because Zoom is, you know, we're on a Zoom call right now, and it's not exactly, you know, it's not the same as if I was sitting next to the two of you and we were having like a real conversation. But we do this all day long, and it's exhausting, and it gets it lacks creativity eventually, and it lacks, like, you know, the palpable spontaneity of in-person interaction. And so, you know, I think kids are, and it's probably the positive side effect is that kids are not like spending all their time anymore on their screens. They're not on social media all day long, I think, like they were before, as a way of escaping the actual in-person stuff that they grew bored of. So now maybe they're trying to find meaningful in-person interactions. You know, maybe they're valuing a friend more and valuing like a social distance hangout with that person, or, you know, maybe even their families, the people they can actually interact with in person. So, you know, I think there's some strange, unexpected things that are happening from this that I think are really cool areas that someone could do research. And I don't know anyone that's doing it, or the research is still so new that it's probably not coming out quite yet, but it is a really interesting question.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that point on using less social media. I definitely feel like by the end of the day, I'm just totally zoned out. And then I just value that time I spend with friends in person. Even just going on an hour-long walk once a week, it makes a massive difference compared to what it was like a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But do you think there may also be kids out there that, yes, they're sick of social media, but instead of longing for that in-person interaction, they just close off completely?
Yeah, I mean, I see the ubiquity of FaceTime and Skype and Zoom and Google Meets and these things. I see these things as most everything that sociologists do is they see these things as double-edged swords. Like, on the one hand, they open more lines of communication, and in ways that when I was in college in the late 90s, email wasn't even really a thing. Like, people didn't use email. It was very primitive. And so in-person interaction was everything. But that also limited who you could interact with. So if a friend of mine went to a university far away from where I went to a university, that person might as well have dropped off the earth, because it wasn't the 1920s. We weren't writing letters to each other and like sending letters in the mail back and forth. Basically, that person ceased to exist. And so on the one hand, all these interaction tools, these digitally mediated interaction tools, are great because they allow for so many more types of relationships, and so quickly. And so, you know, they could be quick and fast, and they can be long. I mean, you can have happy hours with people, and you can, you know, connect with like colleagues who are no longer distant, but distant like in the sense that you can't physically see them. But on the other hand, I think that they are also, as I've noted, exhausting. And so for some kids, they don't want to do it at all because it's exhausting. One thing I've noticed in my high school observations, and I'm imagining this happens at the university level too, is for some kids who are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, like the camera being on and like the little window that's behind us showing potentially like embarrassing, or what they would consider to be embarrassing, things behind them that reveal more about themselves that they've had to reveal before, probably makes them want to not interact on the internet, not interact through Zoom, or at least keep the camera off, which obviously has its own interaction problems when you can't see a person's face. And then there are kids who are shy as it is, and they didn't like school before because they were forced to interact, but they could at least hide in a classroom of 30 people. And now, because the emphasis is on making sure everybody's okay, because you don't know where everybody's at anymore, you can't see them on a day-to-day basis, like for periods of time, suddenly not only is the camera on, but like we are more sensitive to everybody. And so that puts people in positions of having to interact when they used to be able to slip into the background. They used to be able to slip into the wallpaper. And so I could see, you know, that this is great for some people, and, you know, we probably all have our fill, like there's a certain amount of Zoom we can do. But for others, it's just another, like, it's even more pervasive or more, I don't want to say surveillance, but it's more like that it's more intrusive than the other forms of, you know, in-person social interaction was, where you could essentially hide a lot of things about yourself that maybe aren't really embarrassing, but, you know, are deemed socially embarrassing, or a person perceives them as embarrassing.
So one thing I just want to say, you know, you mentioned the cameras and whole like Zoom thing, and just something like interesting I've noticed, the observation is that I've been in a few online classes so far, and one thing is that, for example, you know, when you have the camera on, you're basically two things that you wouldn't have in a regular class. First of all, you're seeing the front of everyone's face. And the second one is that you're seeing their name right at the bottom. Because, you know, whenever I'm in a class regularly, most of the other students, either they're like behind me, I don't see them, or I'm just seeing the back of their head, or just like the side. And it's definitely odd to see like everyone's face like up front. Kind of, it feels like you're kind of like the teacher, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of like perspective they would usually have. And I mean, most of the time I would say, like, I would not know, especially in a university class, most of my classmates' names, but now that's something that's changed, just having that like name at the bottom right there.
Yeah. I think that's a really poignant insight. I mean, I joke about this whenever I teach. Before I came to UBC, I was at the University of Memphis, and I would have pretty big classes. And before that, I lectured at University of California, Riverside, where I'd have like 500, 600 students. And I see everybody, right? And it's really interesting because most students are what you're describing. They either see the back of someone's head, but the only face they really are seeing is my face. And so they think they're actually far more hidden. They think of themselves as far less obvious in what they're doing, and like that it's hard for the professor or the instructor to see them. What they don't understand is, from the instructor's perspective, I can see everybody's face like very clearly. Like if someone's sleeping, I can see them sleep. Like if someone is like on their phone, I can see them on their phone. But because of the crowd effect and the fact that they're always in that, what you're describing is this like the weird observer audience perspective, like it's strange. And so it is weird. I hadn't thought about that, but it is really weird that they are now seeing what a professor sees, although it's, you know, slightly different because it's just a bunch of boxes on the screen, and it's, you know, it's really two dimensional, and it's kind of odd, but it's probably like a really weird realization as to the number of people and the diversity of people and, you know, the complexity of like a larger group. Right. And it probably has interesting educational consequences. I have no idea what, but it must change the dynamic of a class. I haven't actually taught a big online class yet. Next term I'll be teaching like an 80 student class, so I'll get my experience of looking at 80 cubes and trying to discern what that means exactly.
What I've noticed is like because I had a few classes this term, and usually for the larger ones, like 100 and above students, I guess cameras weren't on most of the time, so it was just us listening. But for the smaller classes, around like 30, 40 students or so, we had cameras on. And I feel like in a way that did really help to kind of like bring a more human aspect to the whole like online learning thing. Mm-hmm. Because when you're just looking at, you know, you only see the professor and it's just blank black boxes on the screen, and it makes it really hard to form that connection.
Yeah, I could see that. And I mean, I would say that this is a question, is a bit an empirical question, one that is still yet to be fully answered, but you know, the neuroscience, the cognitive science behind like digitally mediated interactions is not very promising. It's kids, like little kids that are, you know, in experiments are taught things through like iPads and stuff like that. Like there's just something missing. And it's not just like a behavioral thing. There's something like in the brain, the architecture of the brain that is not act. I mean, it can be overcome. That is like our brains can like adjust to this sort of weird change in the world. But there's there's just something different about the physical, palpable, like, presence of others, like the ability to see our bodies completely, because body language is a really important part of, I mean, we're the only ape that stands on 2 feet and shows our entire, like, our abdomen at all times. And so body language is really important. We're very attuned to that, even when we're not paying attention to it. Being able to read emotions is something that all apes do, especially chimps. And like, we are especially attuned to it. And even though the technology is much better than when back in the day, it was always like kind of like jerky, and now it's obviously real time and it's far more advanced than it was before, but there's still something missing. And then there's like the other senses that are weak in us and in humans, like smell and like smell especially, but like hearing, even like we're visually dominant creatures, but like we still smell though. It's still like important, even if it's like in the background of us. And so like even like weird things that we're not fully conscious of, like we're missing in these digitally mediated things. And it affects it. I mean, I sit in faculty meetings and there's like 24 of us like talking, and it's not the same as when we're all in a room, even when, you know, there's a lot of turn taking. And I can't imagine being in a class of 80 people with one person talking in a little box. And as you're talking about, and I know most of my colleagues talk about this, most people's cameras are off, so you don't know whether they're there or not. There's no way to really know, you know, and it's complicated, right? I mean, it's the main ways that we synchronize our emotions and behaviors are essentially stymied, you know, to varying effects on the internet.
Great. Thanks for adding that, Dr. Abertson. We'll be right back here on Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM after just one message. So please stay tuned. Let's see here.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, and we are back here interviewing Dr. Seth Abertson today. And my name is Ali Rudd, of course, with my co-host Gurman Gill. And so far, we've had a pretty interesting conversation with Dr. Abertson. We touched a little bit about some topics about just online learning in general and what impact that's been having on university students. So going on, Gurman, I think you had something to share right now.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the interaction that's being done online is very passive. Like, you don't really get a chance to really, like, attempts are made to help interact with other people in the class and with the teachers, but it's not really there. You don't get the full extent of it. When you're in an in-person conversation, I feel like there's a lot more attention being paid at all times, just because they can see all of you. Like, when you're on a camera, you're just on mute half the time. You could be listening to music. You could be on your phone. It's kind of hard for someone to see. There's a lot more pressure, I think, in an in-person conversation to actually be there in the moment.
Sure. I mean, think about, like, sociology is all about social control. It's all about both how we exert control on others and how others self-regulate themselves, thinking that we're exerting control on them. And the thing you're talking about, right, is that two people having an interaction with each other are constantly sanctioning each other when we violate the expectations. So if, like, you pick your phone up in the middle of a one-on-one conversation, depending on how well you know the person, right, let's say it's your significant other, your partner, we have all sorts of informal tricks to like sanction the person, things that don't even have to be said to like get them to pay attention. And, you know, without that in-person stuff, like it, some of it gets missed, but it gets even more complicated when it's one person with 40 or 80 people. The way that I control my classrooms is eye contact. So if I see a student who is on their phone, I can be lecturing and completely focused on my class, but I can look straight at that person until they recognize I'm looking at them. But how do you do that on a Zoom call? Like everyone sees me looking at them. I'm looking straight at the camera. And because all of our cameras are in different places, sometimes it probably doesn't even look like you're looking at the camera. And so what's the sanction, right? What's the control? It's so hard to produce that. And I could call the person out, but that takes so much more time and it devolves and it, you know what I mean? It reduces the flow of the interaction. And so, yeah, I mean, it is a brave new world, right? Like maybe I can push a button and zap their box or something, but that also takes time. You know what I mean? Like that's a whole nother step to control. So.
And of course, you know, sociology is about the social. You mentioned it as social control. And this really brings me to one interesting point that I've been thinking about now that, you know, we're talking about this whole online learning and also the whole like work from home thing going on right now, is that I've noticed that there have been a lot of increased calls for perhaps like increased online education, increased opportunities for work from home. And of course, now people are really like looking at the positive aspects of this. But as we're talking right now, there are a lot of other things that, you know, we need to consider as well, in that because basically the online format of doing these things really changes the essence of our social communications. So what are your thoughts on that, and generally like that societal shift perhaps towards that direction? Do you think it could happen or not? What implications would it have?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, wow. So, you know, there's depends on the industry in the world. In high schools, you know, some of the things I've read are people are like, oh my God, the high schools are going to go all online. They're going to just, you know, turn it into this thing. My observations, both in a very conservative and a very liberal community, is that nobody wants this, not the teachers, the parents, the students, and especially the people who matter, the district and the school board. Nobody wants this. It's not working and it probably won't work. And so I don't think they'll turn that into an online world. Universities, I think, are also showing that it's not working. So I think teaching is probably not going to ever fully go that way. Where there's money to be saved, there's always money to be saved. I mean, but if you recall, you know, about, I guess it was about 7 years ago, those big MOOC classes, I can't remember what the MOOC stand, the acronym stands
for. Massive Open Online
Course. Yeah, right. So that was like, I remember Time Magazine and CNN, everyone was talking about this is the new wave, and all those super famous Stanford and Harvard professors started like running their courses. And guess what? Nobody cares anymore. It's a thing of the past because it didn't work. It was interesting and sexy, and now it's just like exactly what we'd expect, useless. It's like it was a nothing thing. And I mean, they're still out there and there's still some bonuses to like online stuff, especially for students who are non-traditional and, you know, can't go during the day because they work. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons for online stuff to potentially be useful for certain groups of people, certain categories of people. But I don't see that happening. The work thing is more complicated because I think that businesses are saying, whoa, we don't need to have like a physical office anymore. And we can save huge amounts of money not paying electricity bills and water bills. And, you know, there's certain things. But I don't know whether that is really going to be the case. I imagine some industries and some businesses, specific businesses, will go that way. But I also wonder that when this is all over, whether businesses that will use their in-person offices as a selling point to steal talent away, because there are some people who clearly like working from home, but those people always work from home. As soon as the internet became accessible in a way that could facilitate that, there were people who found sales jobs and all sorts of jobs that reduced their necessity of being in person. But I think for the rest of us, for the vast majority of us, those who are honest with themselves know they work more when they're in their office rather than not. Most of us crave the non-strong tie, weak tie office life, right? We miss the annoying person whose voice we heard every day and hated, but it was something that we hated. It was something real, something tangible. We miss the drive to work, whether it drove us nuts or not. We miss the elements of the office. And I imagine some businesses will do it because it's worth it. And there will be people who will always gravitate towards those jobs. And there are people who are capable of working from home and motivating and being fine. But I don't know, but I just imagine that there will be businesses that will use that as a selling point, that they'll be like, look, we have a physical office, come work for us, you know, and there will be people who will crave that.
And one thing, like just from that, like educational university standpoint, you mentioned is that you've probably seen this in Gurman as well, like in the news, the UBC cheating scandals in the first year classes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of focus has been put on the side of, you know, first of all, you know, cheating is of course wrong. It's academic dishonesty, but a lot of people have also brought it to light is that, you know, this is happening in first term, first year classes for students who are going to university online for the first time. Mm-hmm. And, like just looking at it from like that perspective, it's kind of interesting to see how, because, you know, of course this has not been a problem in previous, years where we've had cases of like hundreds of people like cheating in the same first year course at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be a lot of interesting things that come from this. I mean, this is like many people's careers in the making, many academics' careers in the making to study what has happened. I mean, there is the massive ability to cheat. There is the weird cohort effect of a bunch of people who are starting their first year of high school, first year of university, first year, whatever, they just graduated, right? Whatever is the thing, and they are going to like be this weird group of people who went through this really bizarre moment that is different from everyone else that came before and everyone else that comes after. And so, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be an interesting time. Like the only thing that I can think of that is similar is like people who lived through like the Great Depression and like, you know, that it had this sort of permanent scarring and like shaped their lives forever. And, you know, wasn't bad or good. I mean, it had obviously some very negative consequences for a lot of people, but it was just one of those cohort effects, right? I mean, it's just something that makes those people unique forever. And we are living through it too, but there are a lot of people who are going through those weird firsts that have been completely destroyed. Having a baby in COVID, for instance, and like not having the ability to walk your baby in a carriage like safely or like, you know, comfortably. It's just, there's so many weird things that it'll take years to sort of work through and understand what the consequences are.
Yeah, it feels like the rules are sort of changing society as time goes on. Like Alarod just mentioned, mass cheating is now becoming common. There's more opportunity, I guess, for social deviancy. And what do you think the effects are, would be long-term, of the people that have to grow up with these new rules in society?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things I do in all my classes is to remind people to develop a historical consciousness in all situations and to think about the long span of history and to think about, you know, the greatest parallel that we have obviously is the Spanish flu, right? The influenza in 1918, 1919. And the thing, you know, my wife and I have this conversation too all the time. And I'm always like, just remember that back then, you know, 50 million people died worldwide in this, you know, it was a massive like thing because they didn't have the same healthcare that we have today. And at the end of the day, people went back to baseball games. The handshake remained like the normal way to greet people, despite the fact that You know, they knew about germs. People went to dances. The Roaring Twenties, like, were all over the Western world, where people were dancing like crazy and going to parties and like enjoying themselves. And so the norms will change. They always change. But, you know, at the same time, humans are humans. And I think that they will always find ways to do the things that they always do, which is to be physically present and to watch each other in a sanctuary. I mean, the rules have changed a little bit because people aren't able to watch each other as much anymore. And eventually they will be able to watch each other again, unless, you know, we never come out of this, right? But the vaccine shows that at least that's probably not going to happen, you know, even if pandemics become more normal, even if this is like something that happens every 5 or 10 years, the other stuff I think will return to normal. You know, I might be wrong, but I just, you know, history teaches us a lot about this.
Yeah, I think that's a nice, cheerful note to wrap things up on. Thank you for your time. We'll let you get on with your day.
Thanks a lot for joining us. Like, a lot of amazing insight today.
Great. I really appreciate it. You guys have a really wonderful day.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM with Alirad and Gurman.